accession number 18022, reel 4.
Back reel 4.
We had the bivvy, the engine cover, and the turret cover, which were like green canvas. And we used to make a thick pad of them. And we used to put 4 sleeping bags together. And Fletcher used to sleep in, if we had to do a guard or a stag deer at night, Fletcher, which was the driver at that time, he didn't do one because he had the driving to do. So the three of us would do an hour each. So we used to put him as near possible in the middle so the others could get out without disturbing him. And we used to take his boots off and all get in the sleeping bags, and then we used to pull one part of the cover right up over us, and that's how we used to sleep. 2 or 3 times we've woke up and we've been actually covered in snow, and all you could see, when you woke up and looked round, all you could see were mounds of snow up and down, which were other people that were sleeping in the snow. The clothing, as I say, wasn't all that brilliant when we went out first, but we were there part of the second winter. Now, part of the second winter, we were issued with some brilliant clothing. Made at Manchester. I don't know what they call the company. I can't remember now, but I remember it was made at Manchester because they had a labelling, you know. And that consisted of trousers, but same as the knees, and the bottoms were all reinforced, two or three thicknesses. And they were like gabardine fur pile. And then you were issued with a little waistcoat that buttoned across. And I don't know if it zipped. I know it buttoned across. And that was like a green gabardine with fur pile. And then you got the... So you could just wear a vest underneath. This little, whatever you call it, waistcoat on top. And then you had this big parka that fit on. And that was brilliant. Like a gabardine material again. Big thick piling inside, and you could button it right up and zip it up, and the hood had wire in it, and you could crush the wire until you just had a little slit for your eyes. And it had a big fish tail at the back, similar to paratroopers, and you could pull it in between your legs and button it, and then you could sit on cold metal and in snow. And that the second part of the winter we were there, that was the clothing that was issued, and that was brilliant. And there was two things that they were very strict on handing in before we came back, and that was a small arms and the parka clothing that had to be handed in. But they were brilliant, whereas the first winter there, it was a mishmash of American gear and British gear and that. I mean, at one time I had a pair of American tankers boots, and they were brilliant, but they were calf high, but they were laced all the way up, and it took ages to put them on. Now, some of them had infantrymen's boots, and they had a built-in gaiter that they strapped with buckles, and they had these clips in, you know, where you just slip the laces under and that. And for a long while we messed about with the American gear. As I say, a lot of the NCOs, especially the sergeant majors, were not happy about it. We were in our furthest back camp, base camp, where they called it Curra Camp, in somewhere outside Pusan. And we went there while we were waiting for a new reconditioned vehicle, and with Annie being a vehicle mech, he was repairing vehicles, and I had a job for about 8 to 10 days guarding North Korean prisoners of war. And well, I don't know whether they were North Korean or Chinese, and they were building a dry stone wall, and I just sat on watching them, you know, smoking and that. Well, they did all the work in that. There was South Korean with them as well, But we were supposed to be in charge, but we didn't do anything, just watched them. I don't suppose they'd have escaped, because there was nowhere for them to go. No. And at evening, we had a straw basher built, and we used to go in there guzzling bottles of Asahi beer. Because we had that many different recovery vehicles, we broke down once in Chon, and the techage came up and said, "Oh, you know, that's it. It's not a lot of good." They had a tank landing craft, and he said, "Stuff everything that you can on this tank landing craft," and he said, "Go with it to Curie, and you'll be issued with a reconditioned tank, and bring it back again." They gave us rations for 3 days. There were different crew members then. There were a guy called Lindrich, and the NCO was a Pole called Janzak. There were just three of us on the crew then, because they cut the crews down. So off we sailed on this LST with Japanese crew, all Japanese crew. 3 days rations, and it broke down. And so for 4 days, we'd have gone without anything to eat. But we found one of the Japanese crewmen that could speak a bit of English and explained to him that we'd nothing to eat. And he explained to us that this were their last trip, and they were low on rations, but we could have what they had. And all it were rice, boiled rice. So we went down onto the well deck, looking in bins for a tin of jam or a tin of something that had been left behind to mix up with the boiled rice and that. There was nothing to read except a New Testament. And I learned a lot of the New Testament, because there were nothing else to do. We got to Curie. We eventually made our way to the Rimi workshops, and when we got to the Rimi workshops, the company sergeant major that we'd had a run in Taegu was now the company sergeant major at this Rimi workshops in Curie. He didn't know Lindrich and he didn't know Janzak, but he knew me, and he said, no, he said, "I'm not having you in my camp." He said, so we explained to him we'd come over for a new reconditioned vehicle, but he wouldn't have us in his camp. And we had to go to JRBD in Curie, and we stayed there while his vehicle were issued to us. They gave us local leave. We had, we'd about 7 days local leave, and we could go out from morning till last reveille at night. And we used to go down Curie and drink and use the NAFI facilities and that, because they wanted to send us on a training course while we were at JRBD, and we said no. We said we're not reinforcements. We've come from Korea. So anyway, they let us have this local leave. Then when the vehicle was ready, they put it on a ship and they said it'll be in Korea when you arrive there, and we had to go through with the reinforcements which the Americans dealt with. Now, when our ARV, when it got to Curie, we took all the equipment off it that had been signed by for us. We had picks and shovels, crowbars, with spanners, sledgehammers, track pins, and all sorts like that for putting. We had a Bren gun issued as well. We had a Bren gun, we had a box of ammunition, with other stuff like that, and we got it on the train to Sasebo. This was the American way through to Sasebo, and they gave us a meal at Sasebo, and then they took us on to dockside onto a Japanese trooper to take us back to Korea. And the Americans wouldn't let us on with this equipment. They said, you can come on, equipment stays, you're not bringing that on. So I said, well, we're not going. And I've some little photographs as the three of us sat there with this pile of equipment refusing to get on this ship. And eventually, because there were other British reinforcements on and that, and they said, no, if that's their equipment, they've got to take it with them. And eventually, they let us take it with us onto the ship. And I think we ended up back at Pusan again, and this vehicle were waiting for us. And then we trundled, as I say, we trundled up and down two or three times. The summer, you went from winter to spring to summer, and it was like changing a different country. The after the snow, the wind was the cold wind was a bitter factor. And after the snow, then you get the spring, and you know, everything would, the ground would melt, the snow would go, the sun would shine, and then you got a monsoon period. And then when the monsoon finished, you got a semi-tropical summer. So within a few months, you'd gone from wearing every thing that you could wear to keep warm to walking down in a pair of boots, socks and probably shorts that you'd made for yourself. They showed us with KD, you know, the jungle green, and a lot of us cut the bottoms off to make shorts out of them, and that's how you wandered up and down. Personally, I was never in a situation where I was in an infantry line, you know, as the like the people in the Ulsters and the Northumberland Fusiliers and the Gloucesters, as they did their fighting in trench to trench. I was never in a situation like that. The number of times that we fired the machine guns was, we thought there was somebody there. And whether or not there was anybody there, we don't really know. But ours was primarily the job of recovering vehicles, because they were so expensive, and they were still on the secret list when they went to Korea. The first one that we lost earlier on was because I believe it shed a track, and the Yanks were blowing this bridge. This was on the way back from Pyongyang, and they wouldn't wait, so they filled it with ammunition, opened the petrol taps on, and fired it. And they also, I believe, called an airstrike on it, you know, to destroy it completely. I mean, I think the vehicle was £65,000 in them days. Yeah, it would be £65,000. And so, as I say, I wasn't like an infantry soldier, you know, running up hills and jumping into trenches and stopping Chinese like that. We were saving the UK money, if you like, because they didn't want the Chinese to recover any of it. They did, eventually. They knocked some out, but they never, I don't think they bothered with them.
Who?
The Chinese knocked the Centurions out. You know the Gloucesters? Well, C Squadron went to try and rescue the Gloucesters, and I don't know, they lost 4 or 5 Centurions and some of the crews. And prior to that, as we arrived there, November, December, Gloucester Valley, which was a combined force of 8th Hussars, Scout Cars, Cromwells, and RAOP, they got hammered by the Chinese. There were quite a few taken prisoners there and that. And they captured a Cromwell, and I believe I'm correct in saying the only tank that the 8th Hussars ever knocked out was the Cromwell, because the Chinese had put it in a cave and kept popping it out and going bang bang. So they brought the Centurion up and he popped one up, which it was such an accurate gun it outgunned everything. And the Centurion, there was American tanks as well, and there was also Canadian tanks, Lord Strathorn's horse at that time. They had Shermans, but the firepower of a Sherman and a lot of the American tanks was not the same as the 20-pounder, and they hadn't got the ability for climbing. Some of the drivers actually took a Centurion on the hill top itself. And it got to a time where it was a static war, and the scents were dug in on the hilltop, and they were used as mobile artillery. It wasn't tank-to-tank country. I believe at the outcome, the Americans had tank battles, but we never had a tank battle with anybody. Their primary role was mobile artillery, and at that time that the 7th RTR, they were roaming up and down. Their crocodiles, which were flamethrowers, they weren't very successful, so they were used as battle tanks and that. But they had a disadvantage, same as we had a disadvantage with our ARV, that they were slow and clumsy. Later on, when the skins, 5th Inner Skin and Dragoon Guards, they relieved us. Now, when they relieved us, they'd got a Centurion recovery vehicle, which was much more superior to ours. I don't really know what it was like. I've only seen pictures of it. But some of the Centurions that came out with the 8th Hussars, they went back to Curie when they were worn out, kind of thing, and they took the top off them. And they took all the insides out, and they used them as a personnel carrier, you know, for taking ammunition up and supplies and things like that. I mean, they were flying machines, because they still got the same engine in, but they'd got a hell of a lot less weight to pull, you know, with having the no turret on and no insides and that. And as I said, we had the summer, the spring and the summer, and the summer you know, the sweat, whatever you did, if you stood still, the sweat rolled off here at this particular time. Before that, St. Patrick's Day, we were near the Ulster Rifles at St. Patrick's Day. I don't know which company it was. I'm not right sure which company it was now. But my next door neighbour in West Vale, well, I'm saying next door neighbour, four doors away, the Irish guy was in the Ulster Rifles, and we were on leave together, embarkation leave together, before we went out to Korea. So we said, oh, if we ever come across your lot, you know, we'll come over and see you. So they decided to have a football match this day, and they had a football match, more of a booze up than a football match. And I was walking around asking various Ulster riflemen, do you know an Ignatius Duig? And apparently Duig is quite a common name, doesn't sound so to us, but it was quite a common name. And they said, which Duig is it? And I said, oh, Ignatius Duig. Oh yeah, he were killed so and so. So I went back and sat with her own guys, and he says, what's up with you with this? So you don't look so brilliant. No, I said, just find out. Guy that lives in the same village with me has been killed with Ulsters. So, it was a case of, oh, well, never mind, here, have another bottle of beer and we'll have a walk round. And as we're walking round, I saw him sat with his mates, and it were another Duig that had been killed and not him. So I saw him, and we had a few beers together. And then later on in the summer, we were near like a small stream or a river, and we sandbagged it and dammed it up to make a bit of a swimming pool. It was only about waist deep, but at least you could get your feet off ground, and it was cool and wet. And some of the infantry guys came down to Cosbys, I think they were, they were dug in on the hilltops. We were down in the valley, in this little kind of bit of a wood in the valley. And they came down and they said, "Can we use your pool?" I said, yeah, of course you can. Because we were in reserve then, B Squadron were in reserve then. And so we, you know, like you get talking to people saying, "Oh, you know, where do you come from?" And, "Oh, I come from so and so." And somebody said to me, "Where do you come from?" I said, "Halifax." "Oh, bloody hell, this him over there comes from Halifax." So I went over. He says, "Hello, Blackie." He says, "What are you doing?" And it was a guy I used to go to school with. And I didn't know he was in the army, because he lived one side of Halifax and I lived the other. But he'd moved there, but we'd both gone to the same village school. And it were Norman Gledhill. And so we palled about together those few days while we were together. He said, "What's your rations like?" We said, "Great." We were on American dry rations, you know, proper fresh rations. We were getting chicken and steak and potatoes and things like that. And he said, "You're joking." No. I said, "What are you on like?" And they said, "Corned beef and biscuits." So I went to the guy in charge at cookhouse and I explained to him, they were a mate of mine. I said, "Can I eat with us?" And he said, yeah, of course you can. So we got him some mess tins and eating irons. And we says, "Come on, you know, get in queue with us." And when it come to, it was chicken that day, and they said to him, "How much chicken do you want? Half a one or a whole one?" And he couldn't believe his eyes, and they gave him a whole chicken with potatoes and everything to go with it. And he couldn't believe that the rations we were on compared with the rations that they were on.
How could he eat a whole chicken?
Well, I don't know I can't remember if he ate it all, but I mean, the portion was half a chicken. They were so liberal with the thing. And eventually, the ration wagon came, and the beer ration came on. So we told him, "Come down and, you know, have a few drinks with us." Because we'd been up, he'd invited us up onto this hill where they were dug in. And it was a tremendous climb up this hill. And it was all covered in barbed wire. And there was a passage through the barbed wire. And then at night, the passage was closed. So you couldn't get over the barbed wire if you could have done. And so when the ration wagon came, he came down for a booze up. And then later on, he was saying they weren't getting the same rations as us. So he said, "Well, next time it comes up, we'll get you a bottle of whiskey." Because the sergeant at that time didn't drink whiskey. He didn't drink at all. He was teetotal. So we gave him the money, and he bought us his whiskey ration. And that was one bottle a month, and as much gin as you could buy. So we bought a bottle of whiskey, three or four bottles of gin, and his own beer ration. And when Gledhill came down this particular night, and we went to cookhouse and got a big bag of grub for him, and the whiskey and gin and the beer and that, and for him to take back to his mates up on the hill. And he said, "I'll see you so-and-so tomorrow." So I said, "Yeah, okay." Anyway, he never came down. So later on, we decided to go up, and we said to the blokes, "Where's Norman Gledhill?" And they said, "Right over there." And they were the face of the hill, right down. They were like a listening post, and he was stuck in this listening post. And they said, "What's he doing there? He's supposed to come down and see us." And they said, "He's lucky to see anybody." And apparently, they let us go and talk to him, and it started up the hill. And he cracked the bottle of whiskey, and he drank more and more of it, and he hadn't arrived up at dark, by dark, so they put these barriers over the barbed wire, and they heard the barbed wire rattling and tinkling, and so they had a stand to and sent a patrol out, and it was Gledhill hung in the wire as pistols and yoked. So that was his punishment. They wouldn't let him come down for us anymore. And the first time I saw him after I came back, it'd be few years after, I went into Dyer's Club in Westvale, and Gledil were already in, and I ordered a beer, and he said to the steward, he said, you don't take his money off him. He said, I'll pay for his beer. And that was because of all food and that, we'd send him up and beer and that. But I haven't seen him for years and years.
You haven't said very much about the Korean civilian population.
Yeah, we didn't think a lot of them. It wasn't their fault. We didn't know a lot of them about them. The soldiers, their soldiers that we met, was not very good soldiers. The best regiment of the lot was the first ROK. They were reasonable soldiers, but the other one was ragtag and bobtails. They would, and the civilians. You see, with this problem of language, we couldn't speak the language. The only word at that time that I could speak in Korean was mool, which I believe was water, and that we'd learnt off somebody, you know, by asking for water. When we came out to North Korea, the refugees were pathetic. The conditions and that. They would ride on a wheelbarrow if they could get away. The trains were packed with them. The roofs, anywhere that they could hang on, that they could get a grip on. And we weren't allowed to pick them up. And as you drove past, there were whole families, you know, from Mama-san and Papa-san and the kiddies and that, trundling down with what, you know, what bundles they had on the back. You know, the worldly possessions and that. And you saw lots of times at railway tunnels, all the dead bodies there, because the train had gone through and hadn't stopped and just swiped them off the, you know, the side of the trains and that. There were atrocities all over as well, different places. We found it was like a culvert, and there was like rice mats propped up against the wall, and we wasn't right sure what was back of them, and we decided to fasten a rope on them and pull them away in case they were booby trapped and that. And when we pulled them away, they didn't explode, but they were covering bodies up, civilian bodies, and who they were we don't know, but you know, we just had to leave them.
Who'd killed them?
We don't know. We didn't know. The North Koreans committed a lot of atrocities when they were in the south, and the Koreans were poor, cruel people to themselves. If it wasn't nothing to see one Korean, especially a soldier, give a civilian a thorough beating, you know, rifle butt and all the lot. Whatever he'd done wrong, I don't know. Because as I say, we had this language barrier. Eventually, we got interpreters with us, and we also got like a kitcom, they called them. I think they were employed by a British, and I don't know how they were paid and that. And they would do a lot of labouring jobs, you know, digging trenches and digging latrines and putting straw bashes up, and in some cases humping ammunition up to the tanks. They had this A-frame, it's a traditional thing they call it, and it was amazing what they could carry on this A-frame. And if you got into the towns and cities.